Welcome to the Male Mentor Podcast. I'm your host, Lindsay S. Nixon. This is the 11th episode in the Co-Pilot series where we can chat about making the plant-based lifestyle a little bit more doable, especially while facing a lot of the challenges and roadblocks we all sort of come across on our journey and trying to get better. That didn't work. All right, let me try that again.
Okay.
Welcome to the Meal Mentor Podcast. I'm your host, Lindsay S. Nixon. This is the 11th episode in the Co-Pilot series where we can chat about making the plant-based lifestyle more doable, especially while facing the common challenges and roadblocks we all face on our journey to better health and weight loss. Today's guest is a good friend of mine and the son of one of the founders of the plant-based movement. He also co-authored the China Study, and he's here today to answer your nutrition and wellness questions and discuss his amazing new book, The Campbell Plan, which is getting ready to come out. And I actually have a few recipes in it, so I'm really excited. But I love this book. It's amazing. So please give me a big hand in welcoming Dr. Tom Campbell. Hi, Tom.
Hello. Hi. Thanks.
Thanks so much for coming on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So one thing that when I met you when I was at Cornell last year, I was really fascinated about how you became involved with your dad's China Study, like with the China Study book that you co-authored, because you weren't even in medical school then, right?
Yeah, I was actually in Chicago. I was pursuing professional acting and making money as an assistant paralegal at the time. And I got a call from my parents, and they wanted to know if I would help my dad write a book for the public. He hadn't been writing for the public, so they wanted another set of eyes, you know, some communications background. So I got into it, and, you know, I thought it was going to take a year. We ended up spending almost 4 years writing the book. It was full-time work. And it
oh, just, wow.
The rest is history. It just ignited in me sort of a new passion and interest. And so...
You went to medical school after writing the book with your dad.
I did, yeah. It was just after the book came out, and I decided to, how am I going to pursue this new interest? And I decided to go to medical school.
That's amazing. And you're practicing now. You're done with all of your schooling. You're seeing patients and all that?
Yes, I am. Yep, I'm a practicing family doc here in Rochester, New York.
Which is awesome. And so close to where you're from, because you went to school at Cornell too, right, where your dad was teaching?
I did. Yep. Ithaca, New York. And Rochester is just about 2 hour drive away up here on the shore of Great Lake Ontario.
Yeah. So it's really cold right now. I feel for you. I feel bad that I'm in Los Angeles right now, knowing that it's like below freezing there. Yeah. But so what brought you to write the Campbell Plan? Like, what was the motivation and inspiration behind this new book?
Well, I think the China Study success took both my dad and I a bit by surprise. Obviously, we believed in what we were doing, but weren't sure that it was going to be a commercial success, and it was.
Which is great.
Yeah, and I think that as I went through medical school and was working with patients, I realized that even though there's a lot of how-to information out there, and the Campbell Plan is a lot of how-to information, I thought that I might add sort of a slightly unique take or voice as a follow-up to the China Study. So using the sort of same scientific approach that we used in the China Study to answer the nitty-gritty details about what is the healthiest diet and how to do it. So, I cover the basics of the diet, some of the hot topics people are confused about, soy, fish, oils, etc., and then talk, the menu plan and recipes, including some of yours, which I'm very grateful for.
Yeah,
from some of my favorite cookbook authors, that make healthy food.
Yeah, I was really excited when I saw the book, because one thing is I feel a lot of the plant-based books out there, they're so heavy in science, which is really great. But for someone like myself who, doesn't maybe have that science background, sometimes it can be hard for me to follow. But you really break it down. It was almost like you were just telling me, like, you were my doctor and I was in your, I was your patient. You were really bringing it down. And that's one of the reasons why I love the Campbell Plan so much, is because it is very conversational. I mean, it explains it, so you completely understand, but you're not getting, lost. And I know a lot of people, while they love the China Study and they are very excited about it, sometimes it can be a little bit of a tougher read. Was that intentional? Did you try to make it more average person as opposed to super science summary?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I appreciate you saying that. I wanted a guidebook for a lot of the patients I was working with. I was imagining a motivated patient sitting in front of me who didn't really know any of this information and wanted to know just the specifics of the diet and how to do it. And so I look through a ton of science. I really did in putting together some of the sections on soy and gluten. And there was a lot to research and a lot of science out there. So it's not without science, but then I tried to write it and condense it and explain it in a way that was very friendly to anybody who was interested in the topic.
Oh, well, you definitely nailed that. It was really nice. It's almost like a Cliff Notes in a lot of ways. Like, you did all the work and you're just kind of giving me the main points that I need to know. Yeah. And I loved it because it's such a friendly style. It really, you can tell you have that, you know, younger doctor spirit, which I love your dad, but it's a lot different because, you know, he's a lot older. So it's, you know, I felt more like, oh, this is someone I can really relate to with a new, fresh look. It's very, you know, friendly. So I really appreciated that. And I think everyone who reads the book will too, especially if, like I said, they found other books to be maybe a little too dry for them. Not that it's not great, but it's definitely a little dry.
Well, thanks for that.
So I know that you have run a whole bunch of marathons, which is amazing. Yeah. And I actually ran my first one after I was plant-based. But a lot of people email me, and actually when I said that I was going to have you on the podcast, asked about running and what they could do for like food when they're running. Like, they, because, you know, those energy gels and stuff, some of them are vegan, but they're pretty processed and have a lot of like kind of gross chemicals and sugar in them. And I always used dates, but I was curious what, you know, you do, like what's some of your fuel for running?
You know, I consume the amount of calories I actually consume while training or running is a very, very, very small percentage of my overall food intake. I mean, we're talking, you know, really pretty minute amounts when you're just talking about a little bit of fuel during an hour and a half run or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I don't consider myself a strict vegan, first of all. So I'm not 100%. I come at it from the health perspective. So sometimes I will have the energy gels, and I'm not looking specifically for vegan kinds. And sometimes I do sports drinks, which are just, you know, a fair amount of refined sugar. But when you're expending that much energy, that much calories, you just need a quick source of energy. I've done raisins too. That works well.
Oh yeah, that'd be good.
Dried fruit. So raisins, dried fruit. You certainly can make your own energy bars. And it seems like that would be a great thing to do. I haven't, just because, like I said, for that 0.05% of my overall calorie intake, I'm willing just to go for the sugar boost. But certainly there are healthful alternatives to dried fruits, and if you wanted to make your own energy bars, I imagine those would be good too.
Yeah, and that's something that I actually, when I was talking to Gene Bauer recently, is he's like, don't let perfection get in the way of the good. And that sounds a lot like what you're saying too, is it's, if this is the only time that you're doing it and it's so small, you know, it's far better to have the goo and be running than not run at all.
Yeah, you don't want to, you need the energy. I mean, you're doing something quite unnatural when you're running a 20-mile training run. There's no, it's not necessarily a natural thing. So you need the energy, and you're burning through, I don't know, what does it end up being, almost 2,500 calories on one of those long runs? You know,
I read that basically if you run a marathon, you know, the average person burns enough calories to equate an entire pound like body fat,
So if you're consuming, you know, from a health nutrition perspective, I just can't get too excited about where the 400, 500 calories of you know, sugar replacements coming from.
Right.
That's just my take on it.
Yeah, and one of the things that I keep when I'm snowboarding, everyone knows that I snowboard with potatoes, but I also do keep some of those things like the goos as a backup, because I don't want to get in a bad situation where I suddenly crash and burn and I'm desperate for energy and I have nothing, and I'm fine having that refined sugar thing in my pocket. And if the emergency came, and it certainly has before, I was very thankful to have that there on me to give me that energy when I was just like, I hit a wall or I was feeling dizzy or lightheaded, because sometimes you burn more than you think you're going to.
That's right. You go through a lot of energy, and it's important that the number one rule, if you're doing something so strenuous, is probably just to make sure you have enough energy and you're maintaining your blood sugar. That's more important, I think, than exactly the form of stuff you're getting. Now, it's a little different if we're talking about hiking or going on long walks or, you know, day-long, more gentle activities. You know, you can have, then you're consuming more calories. You're not putting out as much energy. It's worth putting some effort into healthy foods, you know, mm-hmm. fruits, natural nature's packages of fruits and dried fruits, nuts, and so forth. But for the really intense, you know, hard runs, I don't get too excited about it.
Yeah. So one question that came up a lot was, how is the message, like the, you know, the benefits of the plant-based diet from a health perspective, you know, in terms of, you know, reversing or preventing disease, how is that being in the medical community? I know your father has said that, you know, nutrition wasn't taught in medical schools, but, you know, you're still pretty recently out of school. Is there a shift? Is there a change? Are they teaching nutrition? Is plant-based on the, you know, talks yet, or is it still kind of, you know, not really out there in the medical community?
Unfortunately, in the medical training, I don't think much has changed in the past 50 years, and it's been noted by just about everybody out there who's ever looked at it that there needs to be more nutrition training in medical schools, and it just hasn't happened. And my own personal experience confirmed that. I had very little nutrition training, and it was focused on biochemical reactions and the Krebs cycle and a bunch of specific stuff that wasn't terribly relevant. We did not learn about reversing diabetes with nutrition, for example, or we did not learn about the possibility of nutrition reversing heart disease, which is just a terrible shame.
Yeah, it's awful.
And so the, you know, in terms of actually practicing and being out in the community, it's still a very, 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 I think, small number of physicians who are aware of how powerful nutrition is, and particularly plant-based nutrition. But it's a growing number, and one of the most promising, exciting things that I've noted is when I go to these conferences and I, you know, interact with other speakers, I see how many different physicians are around the country now actually getting very excited about plant-based medicine and plant-based nutrition as medicine. And that's something new. I mean, that's just in the past 10 years. When we wrote the China study and we wanted to have a chapter about medicine, when we looked around the country and thought, well, who are we going to interview to get sort of the first-hand account? There weren't many doctors, mm-hmm. you know, weren't many names that we came up with. And we did end up talking to Dr. Esselstyn and Dr. McDougall. But since that time, I go to these conferences and some of these nutrition healthcare conferences, there are hundreds
That's
of
amazing.
Practitioners who are excited about this idea. So it's catching on, I think, but it's still very early.
It's funny you mentioned conferences because a friend of mine is a cardiologist and she is plant-based and she recommends it as a prescription to her clients. But every time she goes to these conferences for cardiologists, it's like the exact opposite of a plant-based menu. It's like meat all the time. She almost can't even find vegetables to eat. Like she brings her own food to a cardiology conference. Yeah. And so it's funny that, you know, they're so disconnected. And another friend of mine that works primarily with patients who have type 2 diabetes is the same thing. When she goes to conferences, she's like, I almost can't even eat. And it's like, we know. I mean, the science is so out there that, you know, a plant-based diet can help people with type 2 and heart disease. And yet the conferences for doctors who treat these patients have a completely different food agenda.
I think most doctors realize that diet and lifestyle is very important, but don't have particular training. And when you look at the popular nutrition information that's out there without a critical eye or without much time, what you see is just a mess. You know, mm-hmm. you can go on a website and find the exact opposite of what you and I say, or and you can find lots of them, and you can do it in the Google nanosecond, you know,
mm-hmm.
and they have references and they have citations, and it seems like there's so much confusion, and there are tribes of people who are very passionate, you know, kind of angry and yelling at the other tribe. And it seems like such a mess. I think from a professional point of view, there's probably some reflex of like, oh gosh, I know nutrition's important, but my hand's off. You know, I'm not going to go there because it's, you know, is it low carb? Is it vegan? Is it, what is it in the Mediterranean? So mm-hmm. people are either very conservative and just sort of parrot the guidelines, or they just are hands off. And that's been there's been a big, huge gulf between medicine and nutrition in that regard.
One thing that I've heard that's really interesting too is a lot of people have, you know, they went plant-based and they reversed this, or they got off this medication and they subsequently told their doctor, and their doctor's like, oh yeah, I've heard that plant-based can do that. And they're like, well, why didn't you tell me? Yeah. And they're like, oh, because I just felt it was too hard, or you wouldn't do it, or all the other patients I recommended it to didn't want to care about changing their diet. So that's why I just prescribe pills to everyone. And so I think that, like you said, that a lot of doctors know, but they feel they can't even suggest it.
Yeah, it's, in my own practice, I don't have a lifestyle or nutrition practice. I have a very traditional family medicine practice in an academic university center, and most of my it's a relatively poor population. The majority of my patients are either on Medicaid or are uninsured, and these are people who didn't come to me for nutrition information. So it's because of the setting in a traditional primary care office, and because of a lot of other reasons, it's very difficult to quote unquote convince people or help people realize how important nutrition is, and to ask them to reverse their lifelong habits and tastes to something that sounds gross and disgusting is difficult. And so a lot of people are not interested, and that's for coming, for me, who am terribly invested in trying to help people change. But a great majority of people in that setting just don't want to change.
I remember when I was visiting you in Rochester, that's what you said to me. You're like, I work with, the average person. I work with real people every day, and going plant-based is incredibly hard for them. It is incredibly, shaking, like, their whole life, their whole perspective. And a lot of them just don't even want to hear it at all because they don't want to make a change. And at first I was like, well, that's kind of depressing. But then I thought about it, and yeah, I'm around motivated people all day. All of my clients, all of the people I interact with, they've already become interested. They're already curious. Like, they're highly motivated to change, and maybe they're just struggling with some aspect, but those aren't the people who've never heard of it, or they have and they already wrote it off, which is what you're dealing with, the average person who isn't coming to you motivated to make this plant-based change.
Yeah, or there are people who are motivated, but they tried the Atkins diet, they tried the South Beach diet, mm-hmm. they tried this or that diet that's on the other end of the spectrum, and nothing really worked, and here's another doctor coming up with, like, yes, they're interested, but only to a point. And there's so much confusion and so much noise out there that people don't know exactly where to throw their interest and their efforts. And so there's a lot of barriers. There's a lot of, it's a difficult environment for people who are new to the, who don't really know the science, don't know the background.
Right. And that's one thing that I get all the time is people will say that to me. They're like, well, Wheat Belly or Paleo, or they bring up some book or some other, like you said, website that says exactly the opposite of what we say. And they basically expect me to like disprove it or something. And I'm like, or respond to it. And I'm just like, it's like, that's not my job. But also I can't, It's hard to even respond to those kind of questions, because it's like, well, I understand that's what this person says, and here's science that says completely opposite, and they're like, but they have science. I'm like, no, but theirs isn't in peer-reviewed journals. And they're like, well, what's a peer-reviewed journal? And it's like, oh, and then it's off, and I'm trying to explain like really complicated science, and it's...
Yeah, and then you run out of time.
Right, exactly. And then I run out of time or energy or something. Yeah. And
But I don't mean to be too negative too, because I give this message, and there's certainly people who have taken steps. If they're not going 100%, they're going 50%. They're going 60%, 70%. And they are actually realizing health benefits. So I've mm-hmm. seen many people who hadn't heard this information who do change. And that's exciting.
Right. And that's great too. And that was the story of my parents. They started with Meatless Monday, and then they stopped eating fast food, and they started, not eating whole wheat versus white. And my dad still had a heart attack. And at first they felt very defeated. Like, well, why did we join the YMCA and start walking? Why did we adopt Meatless Mondays and cook from your cookbooks? And your dad had a heart attack anyway. And I was like, but maybe because of these changes, this 20% that you're doing, maybe that's why it wasn't a fatal one. And they were like, oh, yeah, you're right. And, you know, I mean, now they are 100% plant-based and it's wonderful. And my dad's been able to kind of really reverse some of the heart disease. I mean, obviously he can't reverse the damage done from the heart attack, but you know, he's off his meds, so that's great. But yeah, and my mom's off hers too. But there are, you know, like you said, the people who start with 20% and see it, and then it inches them along to the 30%. So it isn't all negative, but it is interesting. Like you said, there's so much noise out there. And I think a lot of people are timid because they think, well, I tried South Beach and that didn't work for me, or I tried Atkins. So, and they just think it's another fad diet, but it isn't. It's not a diet. It's a lifestyle, and it's a permanent change.
Yeah, and people have – it's very difficult to communicate the weight of evidence, you know, this idea of what is the weight of evidence. There's actually a large, huge body of nutritional science over the past 100 years, and there is a weight of evidence where you look at the depth and the breadth of research looking at different types of foods for health that consistently favor plants. But you just can't – you know, everybody pulls a scientific study out of their back pocket, and it's hard in 2 minutes to overcome that
and say, oh, was that study funded by someone who wanted it to say something? So one thing, it would be great, obviously, if we could all go to doctors like you who are invested in a plant-based diet, but a lot of people, their doctor isn't, you know, supportive at all. It isn't even that they just don't know about the nutrition, but they're combative even. And so do you have advice for people who don't luck out with maybe supportive doctors?
Well, I think if you have a doctor that's totally at odds, I mean, really, for example, harassing you or telling you to stop that diet, or to you need to eat meat, you know, everything is you need to eat more meat, then I think you need to find a new doctor, because that's just out of touch with research and information about nutrition. And if they're really aggressively pursuing advice that is so out of touch with research, you have to question where they're getting their information. If you have a doctor that is just sort of observing, you know, this strange lifestyle choice from afar and not really getting too involved, but says, oh, okay, great, yeah. Then you can...
good for you!
Yeah, good for you, but, you know, that's enough. Great, that's wonderful. Then you can, I mean, that doesn't necessarily mean they can't be a good doctor in other ways. I mean, they can be a great, wonderful doctor at diagnosing things and recommending traditional treatments. But, you know, you might have to softly just keep reminding them about some of the health benefits that you're experiencing. And
that's a great point.
And let them know in a very non-confrontational way, you know, you're getting tons of fiber, you're really focusing on getting a lot of vitamins, a lot of fiber, and a lot of fruits and vegetables. There's not a doctor in the country that's going to, you know, scold you for that. So you can educate your doctors softly over time, and you can stick with, I always tell people, you don't need to find a plant-based doctor. I don't think that's necessary. It would be great if you can. It's wonderful if you can, but you don't need it. I think what you need is a doctor who's open to you having a voice in your health and open to lifestyle approaches and is able to communicate with you in a way that you feel satisfied with about you know, what are your options going forward? Because at some point we all get sick. And when we get sick, we need to have a doctor who's going to be good at doing the traditional stuff. That's making a diagnosis, you know, ordering the tests and making a diagnosis and figuring out what's going wrong. And so you don't need to, you know, if you have a gallstone, you don't need a plant-based diet doctor to manage that well. But on the other hand, after you have the gallstone taken, you know, taken care of, yes, it's great to have a doctor who's open then to lifestyle approaches that will help prevent the next gallstone.
Absolutely. And I love that you are so honest about that, because I feel a lot of time in the plant-based community, people make it sound like you're completely bulletproof. Nothing will ever happen to you. But at the end, we're still human and we're still victim of human things. And life can be unfair. I mean, one need only look at newborns that end up with problems. And I mean, they're newborns. They're just, you know, they just didn't luck out on the lottery. And I think that is important that, and I think that's the reason why we've been seeing some like ex-vegans, because they're like, oh, it didn't work. And it's nothing's 100% in life except right. death.
That's right. I mean, some illnesses and classes of disease, I think, are very, very responsive to diet and lifestyle. I think, for example, like metabolic disease, which I include heart disease, you know, and the risk factors for that, and obesity are very responsive to diet and lifestyle. I mean, you can really knock your risk down to very, very low amounts with diet and lifestyle. But there are other things that I don't really know for sure. I mean, you can various cancers, for example. I do believe diet to be strongly related, and there's lots of evidence that you can reduce your risk. But reducing your risk does not mean eliminate your risk.
Exactly.
And so, you know, unfortunately, these people still get sick. But I think you can do an awful lot with your diet and lifestyle.
Absolutely, and like you said, it's creating the highest percent of reducing that risk. Like maybe you can only get ever up to 90%, but that's certainly better than not. You know, it's better to be a 90% risk reduction than, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. So I also one of my focuses too is, you know, I always encourage people, and I made a big emphasis in the book that I think that what motivates us is not necessarily a fear of disease or death or dying. It's actually moving towards love or moving towards good relationships, moving towards happiness. That's much more motivating. And I think that one of the things that I focus on is that don't eat this way to live longer. I mean, yes, fine, if you are obsessed with that idea of living longer, then go for it. But don't eat this way to live longer or to avoid every last illness on the face of the planet, because we don't hold that destiny in our hands. Eat to live better over the next, you know, 1 to 2 months. Eat to live better, to have more energy and less pain, less joint pain. And, you know, in 5 years, you're going to have less weight. You're going to have less joint pain. You're going to be enjoy your life more now through a healthy diet and lifestyle. And that's really a rewarding, motivating factor for me personally.
Mm-hmm.
And I think is more motivating for people in general.
Right. And I love that, you know, really focus on the quality of life.
Right.
As opposed to the extension or, and that's always been true for me. And one thing you said was that obesity is one of those things that seems to be very responsive in terms of diet. And the other thing to consider is obesity is one of those risk factors for a whole host of other things. So if you could just like knock off the obesity, that in and of itself reduces your risk and improves your quality of life.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's such a major problem. It's such a difficult problem in our food environment. I mean, people who are there, it's not really a willpower problem either. I mean, it's not that people who are overweight don't have willpower. It's much more complicated than that. I mean, our environment is really quite toxic, and it's just tempting us all the time
mm-hmm.
to make the wrong choices and to go down a path that most Americans now have where there's excess weight.
And I've been doing a lot of research about how addictive food is and how the food manufacturers are physically engineering things to be so alluring that it's not a question of willpower anymore, because you just can't help yourself.
Yeah, I personally think they've put some crack in Oreos.
Yeah, I know. I was joking that it's like laced with marijuana or something, like to make you.
I don't know. I can't. That's one of the things I have to like draw a bright line. I can't even have one.
I'm the same way. Especially Oreos are definitely one of those for me. It's like no. It's just I can't even have the. I can't. I don't even think I could smell it. I think even if I just smelled somebody else eating it, that would be it for me. But it is, and I really do think, and I mean, there's some research behind it that they're changing the way, you know, the fat is, or even the crystals in the sugar have been manipulated now to like create a burst of flavor. And it's just amazing. And so I'm sure you've seen a lot of the studies with rats at comparing sugar and cocaine and how it, you know, affects your brain, and how people who are chronic junk food eaters, just the sight of it will like make dopamine go crazy. And it's so it is more than willpower. And I think that a lot of people assume that they're overweight or some overweight person is overweight because it's a lack of willpower. And I just think that it's so much more than that.
It is. And it's, and the social factors are huge. It's the chemical factors. It's the social factors. I mean, it's very, very difficult to make healthy choices, for example, when everyone around you in your workplace, at your home, your family, extended family, is making totally different unhealthy food choices. It's just very, very difficult. So it becomes, I mean, I don't care what kind of steel willpower you have, you know, in the pit of your stomach. Yeah. If you're in that environment, you know, day in, day out for years, and these are the people you care about and interact with and love and have relationships with, that's an uphill battle that we just can't win. It's very, very difficult to win that one.
It is, and it's different and difficult to be the oddball or to be different amongst your family or your peers. It can feel very, like you said, socially awkward, and especially if you're the kind of person who maybe is a little bit more shy and not terribly bold, that can make it even harder. I always kind of lead the charge among my friends, and I kind of fly my freak flag, but, you know, I have friends that aren't like that, and, you know, for them to like rock the boat is just terrifying. Like they just don't, like, my husband is such a people pleaser, and he just doesn't want anyone to make a fuss about him. And he's just like, whatever. And I'm like, no, you just, speak up, and he won't. But for someone like him, that was a big change to be like, actually, I am not going to eat that. You know, I mean, his friends were like, what do you mean you don't want to go and get steak at a steakhouse? And he was like, I'm going to order asparagus. Whereas I ordered asparagus. Calm down.
it's not an easy position to be in all the time.
And to get different. So my last thing that I wanted to talk about was the reason I saw you in New York was because of the Eat Cornell program that you have, and I thought maybe you could tell us about that.
Yeah, we have online programs through Eat Cornell at the T. Colin Campbell Center for Nutrition Studies. We've partnered with Eat Cornell, which is Cornell University's sort of online program, and we offer a certificate in plant-based nutrition. That's a 6-week all online program. We also offer a 2-week course, Nutrition for a Healthy Heart, which you're part of.
Mm-hmm.
And they both now are approved to get continuing education credit for a wide variety of health professionals. So we have doctors coming through. We have dietitians and a variety of other pharmacists, a variety of other health professionals. And it's been very successful. I mean, I think it's not a stretch to say it's certainly one of the leading certificate programs, you know, for plant-based nutrition in the country, and we're continuing to make content. We have a website called nutritionstudies.org, and that is where we have a lot of information about our courses and our programs, and a ton of articles and science and information about a wide variety of things in addition to that. So it's for all these things are for the lay people online, and we've had thousands of people go through and professionals who have said it's the best continuing education money that they have ever spent.
Oh, wow.
So it's an exciting program, and we're continuing to build on it.
Absolutely. And that's a great way. If your doctor is, you know, open to it, you could always just casually suggest that for them, because as you said, it is a continuing education credit, and doctors and other medical professionals need these all the time. And so it's a good one to do. And we also, on happyherbivore.com, there is a list of doctors who are either plant-based or support the plant-based diet. But as Tom said, you don't necessarily have to go to one of these. If you can, it's great. But really, it is about finding a doctor that's open to a lifestyle approach.
Right. Exactly.
Well, Tom, it has been so great to have you on the podcast.
Well, thank you. Always nice talking to you.
Yes, and I really can't stress how much I love the Campbell plan enough. And I've read, I think, every plant-based book that there is at this point. And this one, I have to say, it's probably tied with Whole, which was your dad's most recent book, because I just loved Whole. But they're both my two favorite.
Well, thanks. It's coming out on March 24th. So
yes.
You know how it is. It's like a little nerve-wracking. It's sort of like a baby being born.
I've said that about every single one of my books. I'm like, I just felt like I was pregnant the whole time. And I was just like, ready for this sucker to come out.
Yeah, I know. It's a little less than 3 weeks away. So, but no, I'm excited. I think I've heard good things from people, so I'm hopeful.
Yeah, I was just flipping through it when you were talking, and there's so many great chapters. It really does sort of bring up like the hot topics and sort of the big issues, but and even just like the daily living. And you're in, as a new dad, I'm sure you've well covered about kids, because that's a lot of questions I get, not just in getting them food, but I guess pediatricians are really milk pushers, and you know, obviously we're anti-dairy.
Yeah,
you got especially it. With kids. So thanks again, Tom. Everyone get the Campbell plan. And this is Lindsay Nixon from the Meal Mentor podcast. And you can learn more at getmealplans.com.